God in Every Stone is her sixth novel, and there's an acclaimed backlist. She was born in Pakistan, Karachi, began writing as a student in America. In fact, she finished her first novel when she was on an MFA program there. In the City by the Sea was published in 1998. Her second came 2 years later. By the time she published her third, Cartography, she'd been shortlisted for lots of awards. Her fourth was Broken Verses, and her fifth, Burnt Shadows, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize and translated into many, many languages. On top of that, last year, she was listed among Granta's 20 best British writers under the age of 40, which is a remarkable achievement, but actually one that may bear its own particular burdens. You know, one of you may want to go there, or we might pick that up later. But about this book, A God in Every Stone is set in 1914, just before the onset of war. It goes forward, but also backwards, way backwards, to the ancient world, 5th century BC, Persian and Ottoman empires. There's a series of narrative voices. One is that of Vivian Rose Spencer. She's an unmarried British woman, young, with a passion for ancient history. She works in a military hospital in Britain and then takes off to the Imperial India then, Peshawar now. Mm-hmm. And she's going for an archaeological dig. And other voices, there are, amongst them, are two brothers from Peshawar, Qayyum and Najib. One's fought in Flanders, or will fight in Flanders at that point, and the other, Najib, like Vivian, develops a love of archaeology. So there's a lot going on. It's a captivating story because it manages to sort of combine history with just a very page-turning plot, and there's a lot of history packed in there. It's a story about empire, about forgotten histories, about first-wave feminism in Britain, brotherhood, love, and in this centenary year for the World War I, I think it gives us a sort of lesser remembered side of the Great War. It's not just the frontline soldiers that we're seeing here, but it's sort of Indian soldiers on the front. And it's their particular brand of bravery, but also much more complicated sort of emotional aspects than just bravery. Because in the background, we have the struggle for independence bubbling away. That's all I'm going to say about what it's about at the moment. I want, Kamala, if you could, from all those strands, sort of take the starting point. What was this book, your sixth novel, going to be about for you?
The starting point was it was going to be about Peshawar. You know, it was the city itself that was the starting point. Because I first started to think about it in 2009, which was when Burnt Shadows came out, and I was in Karachi, which is where the book came out first. And I would go on these TV talk shows, and I would talk about Karachi, and then the next person on would be talking about political events. And at this point, in 2009, the Taliban were in control of part of the country, and there were bombs literally every day for a period of time in the city of Peshawar. And at some point, you know, one of the TV anchors turned to me and said, here we're talking about your book, about the bombing of Nagasaki in 1945, and, you know, but bombs are going off every day in Peshawar. And it occurred to me that I knew, because of my research for Burnt Shadows, I knew a lot more about Nagasaki than I did about Peshawar. And it's one of the strange things, Omar can speak to this as well, you can grow up in Karachi and Lahore is part of your imagination and Islamabad is, but Peshawar, it's almost as though it's not quite in Pakistan.
It seems to be its own territory with its own particular rules,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Well, it's in that way that there's been this mythology about it always. I mean, Kipling, if you read the way Kipling writes about it, as the frontier town, as, you know, this wild place, it's, you know, and that sort of continued. And it just seemed a little shocking to me that I knew so little about it. And so it was really sort of a kind of curiosity that led me to researching it. And I am fascinated by ancient history, and Peshawar is South Asia's oldest living city. We don't know how old. The excavations they've done show that it's been continually inhabited for at least 2,500 years. They've gone down to sort of 6th century BC. They've run out of funding, so they don't know how much deeper it goes. But the Persian empires were there. Alexander, the Greek, the Indo-Greeks, the Kushan Empire, it was the great Buddhist center. the Mughal, I mean, everyone. And so there are these. So what it started me was excavating layers of history in this city within a country which is very bad at talking about history.
Yeah, and it began with this particular particular city. Brilliant. I want to just draw our minds to draw your attention to Vivian, this central character who's interesting as a protagonist, because on the one hand she's another imperialist arriving in India, all fresh-faced, and she's another symbol of empire in Peshawar. But she's also, I mean, she's benevolent, but she's still those things. She's
Well, if you can have a benevolent imperialist, which
she's the nicest face of imperialism you can get.
Yeah.
But she's this radical as well, and she's a firebrand. She's young, unmarried, independent. She's taken off. She's defying convention, and she's doing this thing in 1914, isn't she? 15. Which wasn't common for women. So I found her an interesting, creation. Mm. I believe she's based partly on a real woman adventurer called Rosita Forbes. Will you tell us a bit about coming across Rosita Forbes and instantly, or maybe not instantly, thinking, this woman's ripe for my fiction? Mm.
It's very interesting, the reviews, because the reviews in India and Pakistan are very clear that it's a book that's about, you know, Qayyum Gul, who is this man from Peshawar, and Vivian Rose, this English woman. And the reviews in England have been so much about, you know, it's the book of the English woman. And I keep like, really? Because one of the weird things for me with the book is that she came very late into the story. And she is now the first, you know, she's the first voice in the first story you encounter. And she's, if you do page count, which, you know, writers do, she has slightly less pages than Qayyum does. But because she's there so much more at the front end, and actually as the novel goes on, she disappears from
the
story much more. But she came late to it, and one of the things was, originally I had a male archaeologist. And then in my reading of Peshawar, I came across the writings of a woman called Rosita Forbes, who's not very well known now, but was in her time, and was a traveller. And in the 20s and 30s, travelled... It seemed to be everywhere. I mean, you know, many, many countries, and wrote about them, and is a very evocative writer, and was tremendously well known. I mean, has published over a dozen travel books and a number of novels and all that. She had an unfortunate characteristic, which was, well, she had a fortunate characteristic towards other women, which was that she was really interested in independent women, or women everywhere she went. She has a book called Women Are Wild, which is about women she encounters throughout the world who are defying convention, who are leading independent lives. And they all have very different politics to each other and often from her, but she's not that interested. What she's interested in is this defiance of convention. So that was all very well with the women. What interested her in men was power, which led in the 30s to, one might say, a rather unfortunate, blinkered view of men such as Hitler and Mussolini. You know, and she tells us things like, by the time I met Hitler, I'm sure he'd forgotten many of the things he'd written in Mein Kampf, and he didn't really mean them. This is written in 1934. And so, you know, of course, her reputation, by the time the war breaks out, just sort of plummets, and she sort of goes off
That's
in a huff.
That's maybe why we've forgotten her.
That is why we've forgotten her. You know, I mean, she does. But what interested me, before I knew all this unfortunate side, there's a book called From Kabul to Kandahar, which, although it's called From Kabul to Kandahar, actually starts in British India. And she's in Peshawar, and there are about six pages of description of Peshawar, which are really interesting to me. And one of them is an encounter she has with a woman in a burqa, where they both stop and turn towards each other. And in contrast to most contemporary people who will see a woman in a burqa and just say, oh, oppressed, terrible, blah, blah, blah. You have Rosita Forbes looking at her and thinking, I wonder whether it amused her to be a secret in the public world of Peshawar. I wonder if she looked at me with disdain for the freedoms she had no interest in. And there's a sort of thoughtfulness in what, you know, not, I'm not assuming that what I want is what she wants, but I'm not assuming she's completely other. There is a kind of, what is going on there? And these two women just stopping and turning and looking at each other. And I thought, I need a woman.
Right.
And then Viv just went from there.
And actually, that whole burqa aspect is something that comes into the book, which I want to ask you about, but a bit later on. So that's fascinating. What I found interesting about Vivian is that I couldn't completely admire her, and I couldn't completely despise her either. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, she's, you know, the brothers' attitudes sum it up. Qayyum mm-hmm. is really suspicious of her version of her going to Peshawar, excavating the history that she wants to excavate. Mm-hmm. He sees her as the agent of empire. The brother, Najib, doesn't. He has a very different approach to her. She herself doesn't criticize him. That's not what she's gone to. She hasn't gone to challenge empire. Mm-hmm. She's gone to endorse it in a way. Mm. She's a feminist, but she doesn't recognize herself as such either. So I wonder if you, she's tarred with the brush of imperialism. It's a central character, one of two, mm. who's a heroic and anti-heroic at the same time. Mm. Did you intend for this to happen, or did she just to turn into this quite complicated creature?
Well, I don't know that I ever intend for my characters to be, I mean, they sort of develop as they develop. She was always going to be problematic. And in fact, Qayyum to me is also very problematic. She's problematic on empire and he's problematic on women. She gets to be quite good on women and he gets to be quite good on empire. You know. But actually, at the start, she's certainly not good on women either. At the start of the novel, she's very anti-suffragette.
Yeah.
Right, because she's been raised by a father who doesn't have sons, so he treats her as, you know, sort of as though she is the best version of a woman, which is not quite as good as a man, but he makes her think that she is an exception among women. And you have people like Gertrude Bell. I mean, I was thinking very much of Bell. Gertrude Bell, who was, you know, fantastic woman, traveler, political agent, sort of involved with Arab nationalism and all kinds of things. Gertrude Bell would lecture for the anti-suffragette league, right? Gertrude Bell didn't think women should get the vote because most women weren't like Gertrude Bell, as far as Gertrude Bell was concerned. And this wasn't uncommon. I mean, the number of women who weren't suffragettes. And so she starts off believing in both patriarchy and empire. Mm. But of course, patriarchy is personally oppressing her much more. And she is a woman who wants to be independent, who wants to go on excavations, and she starts to see how there's a particular structure.
And it's a curious thing because looking back at her now, we would define her as a feminist. She wouldn't herself. And we would define her as challenging patriarchy because she goes off and does what a man is supposed to do, not a woman. It's curious how she would never self-define, you know.
I think in order to take on that, in order for someone to be called a feminist, they can't just be acting in self-interest. They can't say, well, I want to do these things. Mm. And I'm privileged, so I'll go and off and do it. You have to...
A systematic challenge.
You have to think other women should be able to do this too. And you have to say there's a problem with the fact that, you know, it's in a state of exception that I'm able to do it. So I don't think at the beginning she's a feminist. I think as the book goes on, she gets much more thoughtful about it. And then her position does move.
Change. Yeah. And there's a historical account in this book, in I would say the last quarter, that's really significant. Mm. It resonated with me. It was very moving. Mm. And this historical bit is a non-violent pacifist movement against British rule. Mm-hmm. It's not Gandhi's movement. It was led by a Pashtun activist called Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who became known as the Frontier Gandhi, apparently. He's not someone I knew about. Mm-hmm. I know a fair bit about Pakistani history, Indian history, and also I found it ironic because now our stereotype of the Pashtun people is that they're a warrior people, they're a warrior sort of region, and so on those two levels, I found this piece of history quite surprising. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if when you came across the movement and when you came across Frontier Gandhi, I suppose this is one of the sort of secret histories that I thought you were excavating here. Will you tell us a bit more about your encounter with this?
When I was growing up in Karachi, I certainly hardly ever heard the name of Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan because he's not part of the Pakistan's official state's narrative of how Pakistan came to be, because he opposed the creation of Pakistan. He was allied to Gandhi, although I think a lot of the Pashtuns would object to him being called the Frontier Gandhi on the basis that he was his own man, and he was his politics were very much, he didn't take Gandhi's politics, he developed a politics which was very much in sync, but he had his own ideas of non-violence. But he's, because he, you know, spent so much of his life, he died in the 80s, spent so much of his life either in exile or in prison because of his confrontation with the state. The state doesn't know what to do with him, but you know, if you were to grow up in what was the NWFP and is now Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, then you would certainly know about him. It's another one of those regional things.
So you're saying he's sort of been written out of Pakistani history a little?
He's been written out of nationalist history. He's certainly not been written out of Pashtun history. And, you know, if you went to Peshawar and said, I never heard of Ghaffar Khan, they'd, I'm sure, laugh at you. I hope they'd laugh at you.
Yeah,
they'd say,
they'd say, here's
a big roundabout named after him. But I was in... I'm now sort of dimly aware of him somehow, but I really became interested in... About, I suppose, 10 or 15 years ago, I read a book called The Pathan Unarmed by a historian called Muklika Banerjee, which was about Ghaffar Khan and this nonviolent movement, which he devised by combining elements of Pashtunwali, the Pashtun code, and Islam. And it was what made it so distinct from Gandhi is that he recognized that to speak to the Pashtuns about it, you speak in their cultural terms and show how you can develop a theory of nonviolence out of the Pashtun code and out of Islam. And was in the 30s certainly a very, very potent political force and allied to Gandhi and to the Congress, and continues to be in many parts revered. And in fact, when Malala Yousafzai stood up and addressed the UN, she said the three heroes she named were Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, and Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan. So, you know, I mean, he's
out there.
I mean, for the Pashtuns, he is a very big figure and continues to be.
Yeah. So also in the last of the book, there's a protest. There's a sort of protest that I, again, knew nothing about. Mm. Like, we know about the 1857 rebellions. We have key rebellions. This is one protest stroke rebellion stroke massacre that I hadn't known of. Mm. It took place in April 1930. It was ruthlessly, brutally crushed. It wasn't just the death toll, but also the aftermath that, for me, made shocking reading. Mm-hmm. And I felt quite upset and quite angry reading it myself at points.
Yeah.
Now, I wondered about your research process for that particular part of the book and how the writing affected you, whether you were able to just keep maintain a distance, or was it just rather draining and infuriating? And just that research process for that bit.
So this was in April 1930. It was the launch of the non-cooperation movement. So Gandhi launched it, and it was launched by all the Congress parties in different cities and their allies. And there was a totally peaceful demonstration, but it was again, and they were happening all over British India. But because this time it was in Peshawar and it involved the Pashtun, the British couldn't believe that they wouldn't turn violent. Because so deep was this notion that it's the Pashtuns, they're going to take up arms. And there was a very young officer, and it happened in what was, I mean, now the walls have gone, but what was then the walled city. At the end of the wonderfully named Kissa Khwani, the street of storytellers, there was a police station, and this was all happening outside. And a very young officer, new to Peshawar, saw these hundreds of Peshawari men gathering and shouting slogans of independence, and turned and ran back into the back into the cantonment area and said, there's big trouble, I think I saw weapons. And the British basically drove in armored vehicles which and drove over some men. And then there was a standoff and there were bullets. It was really horrible. And then there was a cover-up.
Yeah.
And this is the wonderful thing about writing a book about the colonial period is, the one thing the colonials were really good at was keeping records, and they're all in the British Library. And so I was able to go back and look at the primary sources, which were hundreds and hundreds of pages, thousands of pages of eyewitness testimony. And the British did their own official inquiry, and then the Congress Party and their allies did their own inquiry. So you have both sides. But there was something that came up, which I don't want to give away because it's very near the end, but something involved with the cover-up, which in the eyewitness reports was mentioned, but even the Congress Party in its official report of this is what we think happened didn't mention this cover-up. So I thought it must have not really happened. Eyewitnesses, make up stuff. But then I went back into the original records, stuff that's been declassified of the English governors and people involved writing to each other, and discovered it did happen. And I hadn't read it in any of the histories. And I spoke to this historian, Muklika Banerjee, and I said, do you know of this? And she said, I haven't read it anywhere. Because no one... It was sort of that kind of thing which you need to be looking for that particular detail in order to find it, because there are tens of thousands of pages. And it's only because I was specifically looking for it, due to a couple of eyewitness reports, that I found this detail of a cover-up.
Does it affect you? Because this is... This
well, so this is the thing. I mean, it did, because first of all, it when you spend that much time in 1930, and I was reading Hansard, so I was reading what was said in Parliament about it, and it is stunning, just the degree in depth to which the empire was built on an absolute basis of racial inequality. Mm. And the things that get said, in some ways it makes you feel quite good to know that there's no way in Parliament people could stand up and say these things. People may think them, but let's face it, there's a huge difference between people still think this and it's completely acceptable to say it. Mm. So on one hand, it makes you feel much better about the London you're living in. But it also makes you very angry. But also because... You know, writers are not always the most moral creatures. The day I discovered the documentation that said the cover-up existed, I was in the British Library and I found it. And I was so delighted because it was going to be really good for the novel.
This is key for my
yes. I was delighted, but it was really, I mean, I sort of had hot flushes almost. I was sitting in the reading room of the Asian and African, whatever it's called, room. Yeah. And I sort of looked up and I thought, you know, something... You know, and there are all these people, you know, looking at sort of grain reports of 1832 in Bengal or something around me. And I want to say, this happened. And you have to sort of just quietly, you know, write your notes again and go back. But it was, and I found that I had to leave and just go on a walk and, you know, on one hand feeling exhilarated because it was really good for plot. But then there's this whole other bit of feeling that, you know,
And the document appears right at the end of this book. Yeah. So you see it. Yeah. You know, you see the evidence.
Yeah, you can flip to the last page for a spoiler.
Don't do that.
Cover-up was.
Now, that protest and that whole massacre, it, in a way, it's an unexpected direction for this book to take. Because, you know, as far as I understood, this was about the archaeological dig and the First World War. Yeah. And also... Kayum's experience of Flanders, you know, but in a sense you're joining it up with the struggle for independence, and you're reminding us that those two conflicts would have existed in an Indian soldier's, you know, on the battlefront, and there would have been both those things bubbling away in an Indian soldier's mind. We've seen sort of war, the first and second, from a non-Western perspective. In very few, we've seen it a little bit in The English Patient. We've seen Small Island, where we have Caribbean men who fight for empire. But it's a complicated fight, you know, for them. Now, if someone in this book says, if a man's to die defending a land, let the land be his land, the people his people, which is really powerful. There's a tension within Kayum's own mind that's sort of, it's there while he's fighting. He's doing his duty, but there's that difficult knowledge that in his Pathan's regiment, he's fighting for the imperialists that they're struggling to get rid of back home. You know, there's a sort of irony there. Did you read accounts of soldiers, perhaps, you know, in Indian soldiers, or is there a lack of, there's certainly a lack of account in fiction, so where did you get a lot of that?
There's a fantastic collection of the letters that Indian soldiers sent back home from the Western Front, edited by David Ornisi, and it's in the acknowledgements of the book, and it's fantastic because, you know, these are the voices and these are the letters. So that was sort of the main source of information was this book. There's also one of the sort of key novels in Urdu is a book called Udaas Nasle, which is or Weary Generations by Abdullah Hussain, which has also been translated by Abdullah Hussain himself into English, which starts off with an Indian soldier fighting in the First World War and then getting caught up with the freedom struggle. So it's certainly not missing in Urdu literature because this really is one of the novels of the 20th century. But it was primarily that David Ornisi book.
And you really bring home that sort of contradiction, you know, in the minds of certainly of Kayum, and you do it well. So it's you know. know, the book's about archaeology and war, but it's also a book about women, mm-hmm. As we've said a bit with mm-hmm. Vivian. But so, you know, women's rights are in their liberties, both in the West, but also on the Northwest frontier. Mm-hmm. In what's going on, what are the women's restrictions there for Pashtun women? And the burqa mm-hmm. seems key in some passages here. Mm-hmm. There's a strong emotional element when Vivian puts the burqa on and she's clenching her fists with anger at its restrictions. Mm. There's a part when she says she feels it's an invisibility cloak for good or bad. Mm. You see, it's quite sort of emotional how the burqa will it sort of creates an instant segregation for little girls mm-hmm. who are told to wear it. So one minute they're playing on the streets with boys, and the next minute they're mm-hmm. sort of unavailable, anonymous to the mm-hmm. to their playmates. Mm. So there's quite a lot. There's very powerful stuff about the burqa, and I wondered whether there was apprehension because it's such a freighted symbol. You know, now it represents fanaticism, oppression, women's oppression, being very devout, and even you know emancipation amongst some women. Mm-hmm. So I wondered. Did you think twice, or did you put that in quite carefully, having considered your own view on mm-hmm. the burqa? You know, I wondered whether you thought twice and thought, is this going to be a can of worms for me?
No, well, first of all, any writer who doesn't put something in because it's freighted should be thrown out of a window. Also, I think it's very freighted here, but I grew up in Pakistan.
Yeah.
You know, so where it's not necessarily quite as freighted. So when I think of the burqa, I don't think of how it's viewed from here.
Because it's a very political symbol here, isn't it?
Well, also because it's talked about in ways that are not part of the conversation that I grew up around. And, you know, all this bit where you say it's very emotional, it's very emotional when the English woman puts it on,
yeah.
who has to put it on twice. It's not nearly as emotional when the women of Peshawar are putting it on because it's their daily life. I mean, with the women of Peshawar, it's you know, sort of, it is part of the world that is given to them, mm. And they have differing views about it. So there's one woman in there who quite enjoys the fact that it means that she can look at men without them knowing she's looking at her, mm. them. And there's another one, and Viv herself, who uses it to be undetected, to do things that she wouldn't be allowed to do if she were visible. It becomes a refuge and a form of escape. So it has these different things, but of course there is also that side that of course is a fundamental inequality mm. in the genders. But to see the clothing as a thing that tells you how free a woman is or not mm. seems to me very short-sighted. Mm. You know, you cannot tell what is going on in a woman's head by how covered up she is mm. or not. And there are plenty of women, you know, who you encounter in Pakistan at universities and other places who are quite covered up, and you start speaking to them. And you think anyone who thinks you're an oppressed little creature hmm. needs to think twice. And I was talking a few years ago to a man called Arif Hassan, who is sort of one of the key figures of Karachi, who seems to know everything. And Arif Hassan was saying he's been teaching now he's in urban planning. He's been teaching about 40 years now. He said, you know, in the 60s, I used to teach at a university. In a class of 30, there'd be maybe 5 women, 25 men. The 5 women, they would be wearing, you know, jeans and shirts and all that, and, you know, all trendy, etc. Hmm. And if I ever wanted the students to do field work, their fathers would call up, their brothers would call up, where are you going, who's going with them, what's the chaperone, what will be the living arrangements, and in most cases, they wouldn't get permission to leave Karachi. He said, now, in a class of 30, about 22 will be women. Of those 22, I would say about 17 or 18, in one way or the other, cover up, from hijab to full niqab. Mm. He said, and I can't remember the last time anyone's father called me up when I said we have to go and do work outside. He said, now I take them on 5-day sort of, mm. you know, research tours outside the city. And all I say is, tell your parents we're going from Sunday to Friday. And they all turn up and we go. Mm. And they may be covered up. He said to me, it's, you know, in the 60s, they were not freer. Mm. They weren't being educated at the same level. They didn't have the same mobility. Mm. And let's be very clear, if anyone tried to put a burqa on me, That would not be a good thing. And anyone trying to tell a woman how she should dress one way or another is not a good thing. And gender inequality and segregation, not a good thing. But to think that a burqa is telling you anything at all about the woman inside is deeply wrong.
Do you think that in the West, you know, the narratives that we have around the burqa, they're very cosmetic? Because we, you know, we are sort of saying, this woman is covered up. It's an invisibility cloak, as Vivian says. Mm. So do you think that the narrative we have here, I mean, how is it different from in Pakistan? Do you feel irritated when
in Pakistan there's less of a narrative, and you recognize that there are many different, you know, in some cases the first women who go to, you know, that's in some, I mean, there's a friend of mine whose mother was he came from a fairly small town in Punjab, and his mother was the first woman in the family to go to university and was very much encouraged by her fathers and brothers. And she came from a small village where when women went out, they all wore burqa. And she went to Punjab University, and this would have been in the 60s, and she had a burqa, and she was the only woman who did, and all the other girls mocked her as some backward villager. And it was so demoralizing to her that she left university. These are the kinds of stories you don't hear here, right? It's a complicated story. There's a deep problem in telling a woman that she has to cover up because otherwise she's a temptation to a man and responsible for how he behaves with her. And this is a problem we have here as well. How was she dressed? Why was she wearing that short skirt? It's a continuation, and that continuum around women's dress and women and the idea of temptation and how women should be responsible for how they're tempting men. I mean, you know, that's a deep problem that runs everywhere. But it's a complicated story.
Yeah, and this isn't quite, you know, this is a bit of a off-piece question, but that this is, it's great because it's historical fiction, but it's historical fiction within sort of, it's not exactly Philippa Gregory, is it? Mm-hmm. It's sort of within the last century. Mm. And it made me think, here's Vivian, you know, she's in the suffrage movement, and look how much has changed within within a century for her, for a woman like Vivian. Mm-hmm. And then it made me think how much has changed for these women, you know, in 1914, and there's the burqa, and there's certain restrictions. Mm. Do you feel that a lot, you know, there has been that vital century's worth of change for women in the Pashtun region?
Well, when I went to Peshawar, the archaeologist who took me around is a woman. She's a Peshawari woman. She's an archaeologist. She doesn't wear burqa. She covers her head.
Right.
I said, do you go off on digs? She said, yeah, I go off on digs. She said, it's rare, and you need the support of the men in your family, and I had it. And she now teaches archaeology at the University of Mardan, and Mardan is even more conservative. It's not the norm. She's not the norm. But she would not have existed in 1915,
right.
Dr. Mehrtaba of the University of
Mardan. But it's good to know she's there now.
But she's there now, and there are women who are doctors and politicians and lawyers. And you know, I mean, it's women have. There's a huge difference in the level of female literacy and women in the workforce, and that's really the important one.
And I think we stop with often just thinking about Malala. That's where it stops.
But even if you think about Malala, I mean, you know, you think about the fact that Malala was shot. You don't think about the fact that Malala is Malala.
Exactly.
She's not exactly an impressed woman either, I would say.
So the archaeology, you know, there's excavations of the past going on here, literal, conceptual. Mm-hmm. In some ways, did you feel like there's three main archaeologists, but I saw you as a novelist as the fourth archaeologist. In a way, because you were, I mean, did you feel like that? Because right now you've said, you know, in the British Library, there you were, digging something up, bringing it to light. Did you feel consciously like that?
No, it was, in fact, when the book came out, someone said, oh, it's like you're excavating. I said, oh, that's fantastic. And then
I'll use that.
And then about 10 people after that said that in the next 3 days, and I thought, oh, it occurred to everyone but me. But no, I mean, I was aware of doing historical, for most of it, you know, someone else had done the work of digging things up and I was just reading it. Because the main interest really is for me, or was for me, with the ancient past. And so, how many people here know of a man called Skylax? Mm. How many people who might not have read the book? A man called Skylax, who to me is one of the fascinating figures of history, who was the first man from outside the Indian subcontinent that we know of to travel into the subcontinent, and this was in 515 BC. The Emperor Darius sends this fantastically named man called Skylax to go and navigate the Indus River, and bring word back that Darius can send his armies with the navigational information. And Skylax does that, but then in The Manner of the Old Travelers, writes about his travels. And for two centuries, what he writes forms the Greek and Persian imagination about India. Herodotus, almost everything Herodotus writes about India comes from Skylax, for instance. And they're these fantastic, ridiculous, wonderful tales. And my favorite is that there's a tribe within India. And he's really talking about the region along the Indus River, so what is now Pakistan. There's a tribe called the Skyapods who have giant feet. And when it gets really hot, they lie on their backs and raise their leg in the air, one leg in the air. And it's possible they only have one large foot, in fact. And the shadow of that foot is so vast, it's like a canopy that falls over them, and so they're protected from the heat. And these kind of stories, and I love the idea. I mean, it's sort of, and I was talking about Pakistan, and I said, you know, Pakistan today complains about the West misrepresenting Pakistan, but look, it's been happening for 2,500 years. I wanted to tell also these old stories and of Peshawar and pay tribute to its deep histories. Yeah. So I send Viv there looking for an artifact that belonged to Skylax, and then the young archaeologist Najib takes that up, and he also wants to find this artifact. And so I was, you know, it's not so much I thought myself as an archaeologist, but I thought, I love the work they do, but it's nice that I can sit in the cool shade without calloused hands, you know, flipping through something in the British Library to get it.
I want to ask a few more questions, but I feel like we've cheated you lot out of a short passage to be read. So let's take a quick interlude from the questions. You may want to start at the beginning, you know, with that lovely Skylax. It's entirely up to you, because I just feel that you'll miss out if you don't have a short, small reading, just one aspect, and it could be that this archaeological, this apocryphal ancient history that you're talking about.
Yeah. So this is just the first page, so it's 515 BC. Fig leaves and fruit twirl in Skylax's hands. As he turns the silver circlet round and round, animating the engravings, he imagines flexing his wrist and watching the headpiece skim down the sloping desert of the mountain, across the jeweled valley of streams and fields and fruit, to land splash in the muddied tributary along which it races towards the crocodile-filled Indus. Beside the distant riverbank, his ship is a brown smear. His crew think him mad to have spent all night on the mountain, but why explain to them, if they don't already understand, the wonder of waking with the sun and in the clear morning air looking upon the rushing course of the Indus, which is laid out before him like an offering. He places the circlet on his head, runs his rough sailor's hands over the delicate figs embossed on it, in honor of his homeland of Caria, where men are barbarians, but the fruit is sweet. So the Persians say, and yet here he is, one of the barbarian men entrusted to lead the most daring of missions in the empire. No man has ever navigated the mighty Indus. No man has ever attempted it, not even Odysseus. A flock of white birds swarms around his ship. No, it's the sails. His crew has worked all night to surprise him with this gift. The ship is ready. The sails catch the wind and billow towards him. He whistles sharply, and his horse, tethered further down the mountain, responds. Skylax runs towards the noise, the distance between him and the ship suddenly enormous. Today it begins. Today they set sail from the city of Caspiteras, edge of Darius' empire, edge of the known world. Caspiteras, the doorway to glory. And Caspiteras, no surprises, is Peshawar. Probably.
And that's setting up the key archaeological sort of mystery story on which all the plots hinge.
Yeah.
You've spoken, you will have been asked this again, because you've spoken in the past about starting off with one key image that leads you into the novel. Mm. So, for example, burnt shadows, that kimono pattern on the skin of, burnt on the skin of Japanese women after the bomb drops on Hiroshima. And I wondered here whether it was actually you started with a single image or whether you started with a single historical event, or, you know, was it the image? What was the starter gun here?
It's very interesting and odd. The Skylax came very early. So Peshawar came early, but I mean, as in I went to Peshawar, I went to the history of Peshawar to look for a novel, and then I found Skylax. And I knew there was going to be an artifact. So I knew that that was a starting point. But what's strangely almost creepy to me, and I don't think it gives away the novel to say this because it changed, but originally the novel started in Massachusetts 2012 or so. Right.
Really?
Yeah. And there was a scene in which there are four people standing around a grave, and the grave may or may not have a body in it. And the thing that's creepy is that when I finished the first draft of this novel, it originally ended with four people in 1930 Peshawar standing around a grave, which may or may not have a body in it. And it was only long... And that first beginning in Massachusetts got jettisoned very early on, and I never thought about it again, and I'd almost forgotten that it had ever been written. Yeah. And it was only after writing this ending in 1930, which is no longer the ending, although if you read the book, you might be able to see where it comes from. It was only after having written it weeks, possibly months later, that it, in this really chilling way, I thought, wait, I had started with four people around a grave, which may or may not have had a body in it, and I thought, I can't find how that links to what I wrote, but here again, I've, you know, got four people standing around a grave, which may or may not have a body in it.
So, in a way,
so it was very, you know, so yeah.
There is that image there, so looming. So
there is, and that there was an artifact involved. That there, there might be an artifact in this grave. There might be a body. I mean, that was there from that was the first thing in the Massachusetts scene, and here. So there was always an artifact in a grave. That I suppose those two things were the beginning, and that's why the novel, it has these two stories. There are the archaeologists, and then there's the freedom fighters who get caught up in a massacre. But those two are the one story of the artifact in the grave. It could have been a title, The Artifact in the Grave. What could be a pub, possibly?
Now, I'm going to ask two or three more questions. Okay. I do have lots more, but I need to you know, put a lid on it and sort of so people can start joining in. Okay. Can I just quickly put a couple of more questions, and then I promise. You know, it just struck me in the last two novels are different in the sense that the first... four were very, you know, there was a geography around them in the sense that they were in and around Karachi, Pakistani lives. Your fifth suddenly sort of exploded into this gigantic canvas geographically, politically, historically, Hiroshima, Second World War, 9/11, Pakistan, Afghanistan. Here, again, gigantic canvas in a very different way, historically gigantic, as we've said, from 5th century to BC to...
To 1930.
So I wondered whether there was a sort of a moment, a conscious moment, where you thought, I want to write on a bigger canvas, or whether it was just organic, you know, you after those four. What happened?
It was purely accidental. I thought I was writing... the fifth novel was also going to be set in Karachi. It was supposed to be 1998. In that period, just between the time India tested its nuclear bomb and Pakistan did... And for most people in Pakistan, you know, the bomb was sort of, or the testing of the bomb was about sort of military parity with India. But during those few days between when everyone was wondering whether Pakistan would test or not, there was an article in Dawn newspaper about a group of Hibakusha, the nuclear bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who had come to Pakistan to beg the Pakistani government not to test its bomb. And I just thought, what must it be at the time, you know, if you're... And many of them were very elderly by this point, you know. It was 50 years after the bombing, 53 years after the bombing. I thought, you know, you live through the bombing, and then you have the Cold War, and you probably live in fear that there's going to be a nuclear holocaust again. And then the Cold War ends, and maybe you start to feel it's a bit safe, and then you have, you know, India and Pakistan. And so the story of sort of this Japanese... connection to 98 was there in my head. So what I'd originally thought was it would be a novel of Karachi. It would have a central character who was Pakistani, but his grandmother would be a survivor of Nagasaki, because you do have in Pakistan, you have, you know, people who have Japanese parentage. And so that was going to be, but it was only his story, and the grandmother would be long dead by the time the novel started. But at a certain point, I think, well, who's this grandmother? How did she end up in Pakistan? What happened to her? And I thought that what I was going to do was write, say, a three-page prologue in Nagasaki, for which I wouldn't have to know very much.
There would just be this woman, and there'd be a bomb going off, and then it'd be 50 years later in Karachi, right, you know. And so purely by fooling myself that it was possible to do that, I thought, let me start writing. Let me do a little short prologue in Nagasaki. Well, I suppose I should research a little. Well, this is really interesting. Oh, well, I should research. Oh, well, this is really interesting. Oh, well, I can't write about Nagasaki, but it's really interesting. Mm. And suddenly this is the story I want to be telling. So let me try in order to fail, right? Mm. Let me try so at least I can say I've tried it, I'll get out my system, and then I can go back to writing Karachi. 1998 Karachi. And somehow I didn't fail enough to feel I've so failed that I have to stop. And instead, it became this novel of this woman starting in Nagasaki, and then it became her story.
So it was organic.
And it was totally organic. Yeah. And I only did it by thinking I was starting on the familiar ground of contemporary Karachi in a world I knew. But then having done that, you know, what I discovered was this is sort of really exciting. Hmm. This is an exciting way to write. Colin McCann said it once wonderfully. Instead of writing what you know, write toward what you want to know, you know, which is an interesting way. Mm. And also, of course, you know, by that point, there were also a lot of other people writing about Karachi, people like Umar Muhammad Hanif and Bilal Tanveer and Uzma Aslam Khan. And, you know, it's not that you felt, well, if I don't write about Karachi, no one's writing about Karachi. Mm. You know, it's go and do other things.
Yes, yeah. But does it have something to do with the fact that you haven't lived there for 6 years either?
No, I moved away because I wrote about Nagasaki.
Really?
Yeah. I never felt I could move away because that was what I wrote about and I felt I had to be there. And it was while writing Burnt Shadows that I thought, oh, I'm now a different kind of writer. I'm not writing about Karachi. I'm not writing about the world around me. That gave me permission to go.
That's liberated, yeah.
Well, I don't know if it was liberation, but it was sort of like giving myself permission and saying, I'm now writing differently, so there's a different possibility for both my writing and my life.
Right. Yeah. Okay, last question, and then it's yours. Mm. Granta, so how did that make you feel? How does that change your life as a person, but also as a writer? Mm. And I personally, is there an element in which it's sort of... you can't be churlish and say it's a burden and it's awful, but does it give you a sense of performance anxiety or is there, you know, this is the upward part of your trajectory. Mm-hmm. This is your under 40.
Do you want to give me performance anxiety? I'm no longer under 40.
Don't.
I was the oldest young writer, it seemed. We all sat on the day when the list was unveiled and we were all gathered at the British Council, which was the first time all the writers got to see each other. There was a sort of going around saying, because there were five of us born in 1973, and the five of us somehow quickly identified each other and went around saying, birthday. And I was by 11 days the oldest.
You just slipped in.
Yeah. Well, I slipped in by about 4 months, but I was 11 days older, I think, than Joanna Kavanagh, who was the next oldest. So I was the oldest young British writer. I wasn't yet British at that point, it should be said.
If it's got any importance at all. interesting.
As in, I had fulfilled all the requirements for citizenship, but the paperwork hadn't yet done. It's fine, because they did that with Ishiguro the first year. He wasn't yet a British citizen.
Well,
if you're
going
to object to me, you need to object to Ishiguro having been on that 1983 list. And no one was willing to object to Ishiguro being there.
Does it change your life as a writer at all?
It's impossible to know. I think it's possible for some writers to know. So I remember when the list was announced at the party, I was talking to Jeanette Winterson, who, of course, was on the list in 1993, and she said, this is lovely. She said, now don't wake up tomorrow and expect the world to be different, because she said, for writers who are on their first or second novel, the world will be different tomorrow. Mm. She said, you're on your sixth. You've been shortlisted for Burnt Shadows. Your last book had 22 publishers. So what more is this going? You know, she said, it'll be sort of an under the surface thing.
Right.
Whereas I know there are writers who had one or two novels out who found that very quickly their next book had more publishers or there were more publishers interested.
And then you can get the opposite. Yeah, you know, those older lists, the 80s lists, where somebody has featured alongside Martin Amis and then that's it.
Oh, it's the worst thing. The worst thing about the Granta list is that every year, every 10 years when it comes out, they always have... And
please, good newspaper, stop doing this. Whatever happened to
you?
Yes,
whatever happened.
I mean, it's appalling. It's appalling.
The man standing next to Martin Amis.
Yeah, exactly. Who was the man standing next to Martin Amis? It's a horrible thing that people should stop doing.
It's horrible.
So it's, you know, I don't think, I mean, and again, I'm not saying it makes, I'm not saying, oh, hello, I was always so superior, it made no difference. But what I mean was that it's, I think it's a much, you know, you're not aware of it because it's not as dramatic a spike. I'm sure it makes a difference. I'm sure that with the new book, some of, you know, it's got very nice coverage. I'm sure some of that has to do with the granted list. I just don't, it's not in a way that's quantifiable.
Right.
And also it's a nice thing to have on your bio.